A headshot of a woman wearing a plain t-shirt and dark heavy makeup. Then she's posing in a satin dress and pearls. Model, Vogue, New York, 1928. A naked photo of the woman reclining on a mattress. Muse, Man Ray, Paris, 1930.
She did so much with an extraordinary amount of courage.
Icon, Portrait in Hitler's Bathtub, Munich, 1945.
It's very hard, I think, for women today to understand the degree of the risks that she took.
You see that in Lee Miller's eyes. There is a flame there that is ignited when you see those photographs.
A middle-aged woman with a camera. Photographer.
She went for it, whatever it was.
A head under a glass dome. Surrealist artist.
She didn't let any of the conventions of being a woman hold her back.
Glass shattering while a woman dances. Wartime photo reels. War correspondent. Medics performing surgery in a tent.
I hope no one will ever forget the subject matter for those pictures. I won't.
A black and white photograph of Lee casually smoking a cigarette against steps outside, while wearing heavy boots and high-waisted trousers. Capturing Lee Miller. The lights are switched on in a library archive, and a man puts on gloves before cranking a handle to move a mobile shelving unit. Anthony Penrose, son and biographer.
When I was growing up, I knew virtually nothing of my mum's past achievements. It was a book that she had closed.
Amy Bouhassane.
People were trying to celebrate her, but she didn't want it. She wanted to move on and she wanted to forget.
She packed her life into boxes, Daz and Heinz baked beans, cardboard boxes, and she put them in the attic.
Marion Hume, fashion editor.
Well, my late wife, Susanna, found Lee's photographs in the attic of this old house. My first reaction was disbelief.
A reel of wartime photos. Then Anthony opens a drawer in the archive. Georgina Erskine, family friend.
I think Lee was very much burying the past. And I think it was because she wasn't terribly happy. She cut a somewhat lonely figure.
I had known my mum as a useless drunk, a hysterical kind of person who, even catching a train in Lewis was a major episode for her. I could not believe that she was the same person that had created this material. And I felt that this was a story that needed to be told.
New York, 1927. Archive footage of the bright advertisements in Times Square. Then dolled up women swinging on trapeze bars.
I feel with Lee that she knew she was going to be a star. If you grow up in the suburbs, I mean, Poughkeepsie's a train ride from New York, all you want is the big city.
Old-fashioned cars speeding along busy New York roads.
So Lee goes to New York. She has youth, she has beauty, she's confident. Men take her out for dinner. And then...
cars swerving.
The story is that Lee Miller stepped out in front of an automobile. And as the driver swerved to a halt, the most powerful man in fashion managed to scoop her up. And that man was Condé Nast, who is the founder of American Vogue. And what is a fact is within a very short time of meeting Condé Nast, who had a bit of a casting couch, apparently, but very soon after meeting him, she was on the cover of Vogue.
With hair styled in a waved crop, Lee is modelling a luxurious outfit. Karen Elson, supermodel and musician.
When I look at the images of Lee Miller, I see a woman who is entirely comfortable in her skin, entirely comfortable with who she is as a person, as a woman, and how thoroughly modern she must have been then, out beyond modern, how probably groundbreaking she was.
I knew very little of her as a model. It's not something that she ever talked about at all. Well, she never talked about anything to do with this. She never showed me the beautiful pictures in Vogue of her looking absolutely fabulous.
Lee in a summer hat.
Part of the reason that Lee Miller was such a great model is she'd been modelling from the day she was born.
A black and white photo of a baby sitting on a potty over a toilet. Lee, Poughkeepsie, New York, 1907, by Theodore Miller.
Lee's father photographed her all the time.
Various images of Lee from her childhood to adolescence. Carolyn Burke, biographer.
Theodore Miller was a serious amateur photographer, quite adept at the techniques of the time, including the stereoscopic camera. Images would merge with each other to give you an illusion of depth.
Theodore would probably have considered himself an artist, and he took pictures of his daughter that to our eyes are very dubious.
Anthony leaves the archive and carries a blue box into another room. A naked photograph of Lee as a young woman sitting on the arm of a chair and glancing serenely away. Another naked photo of Lee, curled up in an armchair with one leg draped over the side.
I didn't know about these pictures until after Lee died, and it was part of the stash that we found. I was quite shocked, actually, because I thought that they were an invasion of the normal father-daughter relationship. And of course, by that time, I got my own daughters, and I could no more imagine me taking this kind of pictures.
Lee sitting on a table in the nude. Amy.
If you step back and don't think that those pictures of a father of a daughter, they're actually quite good for an amateur photographer. But the minute you know that that's her dad, then you just can't get over it.
It's a transgression of a relationship.
Jessie Mann, artist and model.
Theodore's photographs of Lee, I see as a collaboration. I see her as a participant. I see a life experience so similar to my own. When Mom was working on a photograph, it was a family affair. I grew up in a family where we were very comfortable with nudity and being nude around each other. And it's very sad that people cannot conceive of Lee engaging in nudity around her father without it becoming sexualized. I think women and children in art, the assumption is one of exploitation, and that is not what I see at all with her as a child subject or as an adult subject.
He did bring her up as his favorite model, and this continued into her teens and early 20s, apparently without any distress or qualms or worries on her part, as far as we can tell.
Lee and Theodore Miller photographed together by Man Ray. Lee dressed in a casual drop-waist dress and a cloche hat in Vogue USA, 1928, by Edward Steichen.
Having already learned quite a bit about photography at home, she could talk photography with the great photographers like Steichen, with whom she worked. She was probably forming the idea that she'd like to take the photographs herself. And I think it was Steichen who said, well, if you want to study with one of the greats, you should go to Paris and study with Man Ray.
People waving excitedly towards the New York skyline from a ship as it set sail. Paris, 1930. Vintage cars speeding towards the Arc de Triomphe.
Paris in the late 20s was the center of the world. Paris is Paris, and Paris is jazz,
and Lee is jazz. Being in Paris in the 30s for a woman like Lee was literally about ripping your corset off. Because, you know, it's when fashion changes, it's when the world changes. It's a moment of just huge possibility.
You know, Lee, first I think we'd better clear up just how you happened to be a photographer in the first place.
I thought the best way was to start out studying with one of the great masters in the field, Man Ray.
In Town Tonight, a US radio interview, 1946.
He was in Paris at that time, so I went to him and said, "Hello, I'm your new student and apprentice." He said, "Oh, no, you're not. I don't have students or apprentices." I said, "You do now."
At first, she was his student. She was also his studio assistant. But they also became lovers early on.
A nude photo of Lee by Man Ray.
Why did Lee Miller, golden, beautiful, fashionable, fall for a man who was basically half her height, not very golden, because she had much to learn and he was a great photographer?
Archive footage of Man Ray smoking a cigarette.
For Man Ray, I think it was the incarnation of the most improbable relationship that he could have imagined. This incredibly beautiful white Anglo-Saxon Protestant from New York dropping into his lap and his life in this way.
The lens is adjusted on a vintage camera, then the light flashes. Lee naked and wearing a mesh sleeve, photographed by Man Ray.
There's still so much that Man Ray did with Lee Miller that was groundbreaking. I don't think anyone had ever seen photography as that sort of daring. This level of artistic genius between the pair of them, it resonates in photography today.
The sleeve casts a shadow on Lee's abdomen.
She understands what Man Ray is asking of her. From my personal experience, there is this sense of just knowing what the photographer wants and manipulating yourself into these sort of shapes and positions, but also being attuned to sort of look into the camera and convey life. It is an alchemy of two people, the photographer, the muse.
Typically, historically, the artist has then taken the photographs, produced amazing work, and walked away saying, "Look at this amazing work that I made," as opposed to saying, "Look at this gift I've been given and the extraordinary magic of this collaboration." And he did not negate her in retrospect, which I think, again, speaks volumes about her, the extent of the respect that he had for her.
The image of an eye attached to the pendulum of a metronome that ticks from side to side. A photo of Lee looking in a mirror wearing a tall costume bonnet.
Lee and Mann fit perfectly into the world of the surrealists in the 1930s. That movement seemed very, not only very unconventional, but very freeing for the women as well. To be treated not only as muses, but as muses who were themselves artists and could participate.
A self-portrait by Lee.
Lee's relationship with Man Ray changed her life in the sense that it really made her into a surrealist photographer. She could already do the fashion and stuff like that. But I think Man Ray really encouraged that wonderful element in her work, which is the surreal.
A picture of a woman's back as she leans down, nude bent forward. Then an image of a woman's head with her eyes closed under a glass dome. Tanya Ram under a bell jar. Both captured in Paris in 1930 by Lee Miller. A row of rats on a wooden rod from behind. Untitled Rat's Tales, 1930 by Lee Miller.
I do think with Lee Miller, she is much more lauded as an artist and a creator, as well as a muse. I see a woman who is in charge and She's the one calling the shots, and I just love that.
People forget that she actually had her own studio in Paris, and she was working and doing her own commissions and working with Ahoinigin Hune, who is the boss of Paris Vogue Studios.
A bust of a woman's torso hanging on the wall and Man Ray sleeping on the bed below it, beside a vintage photography lamp.
He did everything he could, almost, to further her photographic career. However, he also wanted to control her.
The eye on the metronome moves with each tick.
I think we could see it as the relationship of a much younger woman with a much older man, that initially the power lies with the man, and then there's the shift, and it lies with the woman. And the ending, really, with Man Ray, is she got what she wanted.
And he struggled to try and possess and control this totally uncontrollable woman. And that's what broke them apart in the end, after 3 years.
Black and white footage, travelling along a river under bridges, with the Eiffel Tower looming on one side. Then a ship sailing across the sea, and grainy footage of the New York skyline. New York, 1934. A newlywed couple get into a vintage car outside a large building, as the wedding party cheers and throws rice.
Lee Miller, a bride. Poughkeepsie, New York, September the 4th. Mr. and Mrs. Theodore H. Miller of this city today announced the marriage of their daughter, Lee Miller, to Aziz Eloui Bey of Cairo, Egypt.
Archive footage of a city from above with an ornate minaret. Women wearing niqabs are transported on a wooden cart pulled by a donkey. Then a man rides a camel under an archway. A photograph of Lee with a man.
Why did Lee Miller marry an Egyptian businessman that she'd met, I believe, skiing and moved to Cairo? He is extremely wealthy, but he also offers her a kind of magic carpet to the Arabian Nights in her mind. So they get married very quickly in City Hall, and she tells her parents something along the lines of, oh, you know that guy Aziz? Well, I just married him.
She found in Cairo a very luxurious establishment with servants and cooks and all sorts of people to look after her. And for a time, she found a great change of scene which interested her. For several years, she was quite happily immersed in her new life. But in time, this too became insufficient for her.
Footage of women playing a game on the deck of a boat. Then a photo of Lee outside, glancing coyly over the rim of her circular sunglasses. A woman holds on as the camel she's sitting on rises to its feet.
Lee realized it was full of people who were pickled with drink and dried in the sun, and the women had nothing to do. And I think she got bored extremely quickly.
Lee lounging naked.
As an antidote to the boredom of life, she found her Rolleiflex and started taking pictures again. And this was one of the most exciting photographic periods of her career.
A wave of sand ripples through the air. A photograph of the curved line at the peak of a sand dune. Then a man wearing skis with dark shorts and long socks up to his knees, perched on the top of the steep drop. Egypt, 1937, by Lee Miller. A woman smiles as she begins to ski down the slope. Then an antelope's head with corkscrewing horns in a wooden crate.
So she began going on expeditions into the desert to take very unusual and, to my mind, highly successful photographs that have almost a more spiritual dimension.
The desert through ripped fabric. Portrait of space.
Certainly the picture she made through the torn fly screen, Portrait of Space, that shows that kind of conjunction of all of the surreal qualities, all of her internal feelings in that one shot, in that one place.
It seems almost meditative to me. She had a strong desire to escape into something else and another place. And it was in Egypt that she could explore that.
Amy Bouhassain, Lee's granddaughter.
When she was married to Aziz and living in Egypt, she even writes about it in her letters, that she feels like she needs to be a proper wife. And she knows what the expectations are, but she just finds it too hard. And it just doesn't work.
Aziz knew that Lee was unhappy in Cairo and pining for Paris, so he bought her an airline ticket.
An aeroplane flying by the pyramids.
And she flew to Paris, and on the night she arrived, she heard that there was this big party on.
Blurred costumed dancers.
And it was a fancy dress party, and all of her surrealist friends was there. It must have been the most wonderful reunion. And that's where she met my dad, Roland Penrose.
A photo of Roland with Man Ray.
I think Aziz shot himself in the foot, really, didn't he? Because he was so nice and bought her a ticket to go to Paris to see her friends. And then the same night, she meets my granddad. It's a bit like, damn. If you'd known, would you have bought the ticket, Aziz?
Roland and Lee gazing at each other.
Lee is now, I think it'd be fair to say, in lust with Roland Penrose, and he feels exactly the same.
France, 1937. The sun shining through palm leaves, then boats sailing on the sparkling sea. Marion.
So there is one extraordinary photograph which kind of sums up 1937 in Lee's life. They are on this holiday with a group of people to the south of France.
I see a lot of guys with their tops on and women with their tops off in the picnic picture, which if you ever want anything to encompass the surrealists, is a great one. Also, you know, if you zoom close into Roland, you can see an Englishman who's desperately trying to break free from his Victorian upbringing, as he's looking very kind of, yes, I'm studying liberation here.
She was the sort of person that he wanted to be in some respect.
A topless Lee smiling at the picnic. Archive footage of a rocky mountain by the sea, then sailboats docked on the shore. Various photographs taken in France.
The dynamic of the surrealists is a dynamic of free love, but free love which tends to favour men having the free love that they want and not so much the women. Then you put Lee Miller into that mix.
Topless photos of Lee on the beach.
And Lee is definitely someone who always thinks, well, I don't see why men should be able to do something that I can't.
By the sea, Lee and a female friend in their swimsuits are cheekily posing, bent over with their bottoms pressed together.
For her to own the power of her sexuality, to harness it and then to enjoy it for herself, I mean, that's crazy. I'm so proud of all the sex she had, right? Like, way to go. It makes me so happy to know that there is a blip in history where at least one woman had a good time.
Lee smoking at the picnic.
It's one of those moments where everyone in that photograph is signaling, I couldn't be anywhere else than here right now. It's a moment of extraordinary happiness and joy, but most of all, freedom. And when we look at it now, of course, it's very poignant because what they know, and they do know, is that war is coming.
Lee smiling next to Roland as they relax together on the sand.
The summer of 1937 was a wonderful affair with my granddad, but she did go back. She went back to Egypt.
Archive footage of camels walking, with pyramids standing majestically in the distance. A letter from Roland to Lee in 1937.
Darling Lee, this is hell. Another week gone and still no news of you. 3 weeks now since your last letter arrived. I get more and more depressed and worried every day.
It still takes him 2 years to convince her that he's the guy.
When I got married, I really did it for better or for worse. With that little idea blown to hell by this summer and you, it makes me cynically suspicious of any attachment I might make. Aziz and I had a long conversation about you and my situation in general. He doesn't want to divorce me unless he's sure I'm going to be happy and taken care of elsewhere.
It was inevitable that Lee left him because she just could not live without the artistic environment that she had experienced in Paris or even New York.
I don't know how she does it, by the way, with her men. I don't know how she manages to keep all her men in love with her right the way through her life. Man Ray is still there. Aziz, she treats him terribly and has all sorts of affairs behind, you know, but he knows about them. And he even says, if you leave me, can I be one of your lovers? But when she left him, he gave her a portfolio of shares so that she could always be independent. And he, what an amazing guy.
London, 1939. In black and white, footage of vintage cars driving by the Houses of Parliament. Next, the powerful beam of a searchlight in the gloomy night sky. Flickering film of heavy gunfire from an anti-aircraft weapon. Then a fiery inferno. A photograph of a collapsed building creating an archway, named Bridge of Sighs. Rubble teeming from the opening of a religious building, titled Nonconformist Chapel, both taken in 1940 by Lee.
What brought Lee Miller to London is Roland Penrose. He is absolutely loaded. But Lee's very independent, so she wants her own job. So what does Lee know? She knows how to model, not madly useful, in a city under bombardment, and she knows how to take photographs.
A destroyed typewriter in pieces. Remington Silent, 1940 by Lee.
One day she meets the most dowdy, unfashionable, tweedy, blue stocking woman. And this British woman, who could not be less like glamorous, American, scintillating, gorgeous Lee Miller, is the editor of Vogue, and she is Audrey Withers.
Audrey smiling while wearing a chic hat.
And Lee offers Audrey everything she needs.
A model in a checked skirt suit and holding a newspaper peers into recycling sacks. British Vogue, 1942 by Lee Miller. Women in a dressing room.
Vogue is a fashion magazine. Britain is a country under rationing. So what Vogue celebrates is kind of make do and mend.
Cutting off the brim of a hat.
And so Lee is taking the pictures. I mean, some of the pictures are sort of hilarious because the clothes, of course, are borderline hideous.
A vest buttoned at the back, then a broad-shouldered suit jacket cinched at the waist. A sombrero on top of a woman's scarved head as she poses with a lasso. Hilary Roberts, Senior Curator, Imperial War Museums.
Audrey Withers was an extraordinary woman in her own right. She had a real interest in women's rights, in women's independence, and in the creativity and contribution that they could make. Women's magazines were key because you have to remember that many British men were in the armed forces and serving overseas, and that it was women who were not only running the household, but also taking over men's roles. And so if the Ministry of Information wanted to get a general message out, they always factored in the women and the women's magazines in particular.
Pages of the magazine in a printing press. London hats, British themes, in Vogue 1941. Lee flicking through a selection of photos.
Lee's transition from being a lapsed fashion photographer to shooting for Vogue was actually not a huge step. The big step was when she became a photojournalist.
A feature story in a magazine titled Nightlife Now, with a picture of two silhouettes in front of a large searchlight. Various photographs of women working manual jobs from 1942 to 44. Then Lee signing a document.
And then one day she meets a young Life magazine photographer called Davy Sherman. And each has what the other needs.
David speaking to a soldier.
David Sherman is a really very, very good photographer who is already, you know, completely blooded in war. He's quite heroic, actually.
David Sherman was befriended by Lee, and they struck up an extraordinarily close friendship.
And Roland invited Sherman to come and live with them. It was a ménage à trois.
They were having a jolly good time, those three.
David Sherman taught her the art of news photography, and in order to do what she wanted to do, which was take photographs that mattered, that were relevant to the war effort, and not simply be confined to fashion, she had to become an official war correspondent.
I explained to Lee that why didn't, you're an American, why don't you just get a uniform and get accredited to the American Army? And she said, that's a good idea. So she promptly bought a uniform in Savile Row, had it specially made. She took it very seriously and decided that she would be a war photographer.
Audrey wants Lee to cover the war. Lee desperately wants to cover the war. Lee always sees an opportunity. So war is opportunity, and just goes, I could do that.
Saint-Malo, northern France, August 1944. Archive footage of tanks moving along a dirt road.
Lee Miller gets dumped into this town that's pacified to do a story on women, and suddenly she's under sniper fire. And one can only imagine that she would have been utterly terrified, but then slightly exhilarated.
Black and white footage of clouds of smoke erupting from bombs and fighter planes speeding through the sky, interposed with various photographs changing in tone that depict explosions on hills in the distance. Hillary.
The story was one of mistaken intelligence. She was able to go there because it was thought that St. Malo had already fallen, that the battle was over. In fact, it was pretty much just beginning.
From outside the town, we heard bombers approaching over our shoulder. There were three groups of B-26s. They passed, and we could see the bombs away by their attitude, if nothing else.
A photograph of Lee with soldiers in 1944.
I had the clothes I was standing in, a couple of dozen films, and an eiderdown blanket roll. I was the only photographer for miles around, and I now owned a private war.
Remember that she had no training for this sort of work, no professional training as a photographer had prepared her for this sort of work. It was work it out as you go along.
Planes flying in formation in the sky, then footage of a bomb dropping over fields and an explosion.
Deadly hit. For a moment, I could see where and how. Then it was swallowed in smoke, belching, mushrooming and columning, towering up, black and white. Our house shuddered and stuff flew in the window. More bombs crashing, thundering, flashing, like Vesuvius.
Lee's photo of the Earth erupting in a huge dark cloud.
The difficult bit was becoming a writer. She'd never written anything before, but now suddenly she was having to put words to pictures.
I sheltered in a Kraut dugout, squatting under the ramparts. My heel ground into a dead, detached hand, and I cursed the Germans for the sordid, ugly destruction they had conjured up in this once beautiful town. I picked up the hand and hurled it across the street and ran back the way I'd come, bruising my feet and crashing into the unsteady piles of stone and slipping in blood. Christ, it was awful.
As a war photographer, I think it's actually important to have fear, but to know how to manage it. Because that will also keep you alive. You know, I think if you're fearless, you're likely to get killed pretty quickly.
Lindsay Adario, photojournalist and author. Photos in Afghanistan.
At one point, I had to run through sniper fire, and, you know, ISIS was 150 meters away. I mean, that's nothing. And, I mean, the fear that, you know, just leading up to that run between buildings, you know, was like, will this be my last, you know, run? Will I die? Will I get shot? There's an adrenaline rush, of course, that gets you through.
Lee wearing combat gear with soldiers.
Definitely women like her blazed a trail. I think there is a type of woman that goes into this war. Women who were tough but funny, irreverent, who really rejected all the norms of what women's lives should have been at that time.
Lee holding a flag. Hillary.
There were no British female photographers who did what Lee Miller did. For the Americans, they had a more open policy. But the fact that there were only four women photographers who were accredited in that respect gives you an idea of how rare it still was.
A self-portrait of Lee in her military outfit taken in a mirror. Then medics attending to a man with a bandage around his head. Another man on a rudimentary stretcher.
The whole body of work from St. Malo is fascinating because it shows an evolution in Lee Miller's thinking. The tone and the mood darkens. And I would say that that is almost a turning point in Lee Miller's war, because this is where, if you like, she had her baptism of fire. And from here on in, until the very end of her time as a war correspondent, this darker note never quite leaves her photography.
Archive footage of crowds of elated people. Paris liberated, August 1944.
Dear Audrey, I won't be the first woman journalist in Paris, but I'll be the first dame photographer, I think, unless someone parachutes in. It is bitter to me to go to Paris now that I have a taste for gunpowder.
A photo of Lee, writing by David.
Could you arrange that Roland Penrose could read my piece soon, as I haven't written him or anyone yet?
Lee had fantastic stamina. I would simply go to sleep. Wake up about 6 or 8 hours later, and she was still there, knocking, tapping away at the typewriter.
Our boys were kissed and cheered and showered with presents. They battled in one square and celebrated in the next.
We were the first photographers in many places. In fact, it got to be sort of a joke. I remember Marguerite Higgins of the New York Herald Tribune would continually arrive at a spot and say, how does it happen that when I'm just arriving at some spot, Lee Miller and Dave Sherman are just leaving?
David in 1985. Two women sitting by the rubble of a bombed building in Cologne, 1945.
As she moved eastward with David Sherman, her hatred for the Germans increased dramatically as she saw the results of the war.
Leipzig, Germany, April 1945. Smashed window panes in the background of a photograph, interposed with flashing negative images of a body. A girl with a German armband on her coat is lying motionless on a sofa. Regina Lizzo by Lee Miller.
The love of death, which is the under pattern of the German living, caught up with the high officials of the regime, and they gave a great party, toasted death and Hitler, and poisoned themselves.
Bodies in an office.
Leaning back on the sofa is a girl with extraordinarily pretty teeth, waxen and dusty.
I think the power of that image is sort of how quietly beautiful it is. I think the light is very soft, and I think the composition is beautiful. And I think that's very eerie, of course, given the context and given what had just happened. But to me, that's really the power of a good photograph, is that A, it evokes emotions that are unexpected, but B, it makes you ask questions. And I think that that's exactly what that image does.
Footage of a quiet town with half-timbered buildings.
Germany is a beautiful landscape, dotted with jewel-like villages, blotched with ruined cities. The children have stilts and marbles and tops and hoops, and they play with dolls. Mothers sew and sweep and bake, and farmers plow and harrow, all just like real people. But they aren't. They are the enemy. This is Germany, and it is spring.
A black and white photograph of two soldiers, one with a gun over his shoulder, both standing on a wooden step as they peer inside a dark open train carriage. There are crumpled bodies piled on the carriage floor. One person's legs are hanging out of the opening, and his clothes are dirty. Dachau concentration camp, April 1945. Carolyn.
Lee's arrival with Dave Sherman at Dachau is one of the central times in her story. They came just in the very process of the liberation of Dachau.
A photograph of men looking solemn, with their hands behind their heads. Then men wearing caps and striped clothing, lifting an emaciated, nearly naked corpse onto a pile of bodies on a truck bed.
She felt it to be a deep moral calling to reveal the truth as she understood it.
Lee by a military vehicle. David.
Well, we had to just sort of steel ourselves for it, like a surgeon going into an operating room or like a police examiner going into a morgue to do a post-mortem. If you started worrying about it, you'd go to pot right away. You'd just go come apart at the seams.
Harrowing photographs.
If you have a camera in your hand, you suddenly think about it only, and it's being a job, then you simply steel yourself to the horrors of the thing.
I implore you to believe this is true. I usually don't take pictures of horrors, but don't think that every town and every area isn't rich with them. I hope Vogue will feel that it can publish these pictures.
Audrey Withers and American Vogue agreed to publish this work. I think that coverage is the most graphic and difficult that Vogue magazine has ever carried.
The pictures from Dachau are incredible. I don't know if this day and age if people would publish them as much because, ironically, the more violence we see and the more we're inundated with images, the more kind of prude we get. Those images of bodies stacked on top of each other, you don't see those. And that's happening. I mean, there are mass graves being unearthed in Syria now, you know, but we don't see those images.
A corpse in water. Dead SS guard. Dachau, 1945.
I have met nobody who has seen those scenes in any concentration camp, who has talked about them willingly or has been able to walk away from them.
Men in striped clothes crouching.
I had seen nothing. She kept everything away from me.
People gathering by heaps of clothing on the ground.
I think that Lee definitely did not want to revisit that experience by talking about it.
A shadowy figure moves behind a hazy wall of glass, then presses a hand against the surface and lowers its head. Lindsay.
You know, we're all very, very different, and we all process trauma and these scenes in a very different way. So I can't possibly know how she felt and what she walked away feeling. But I do know for myself, you know, it's important when I walk away from a scene like that to revisit it and to talk about it a lot. And that's sort of how I deal with my own trauma.
Hands moving behind the glass.
A lot of people with PTSD, they never deal with it and they just shut down and it doesn't go away. And in fact, it's been proven that it gets worse over time.
Lee lying on a garden bench at home in 1953.
I interviewed several friends who were very young women at the time when they visited Lee at Farley Farm, who said that sometimes late at night at 3 a.m., if they stayed up with Lee and drank with her, because she would drink a great deal, she would break down and sometimes cry and tell them, you have to be careful about what you let yourself in for. And she would allude sometimes briefly to those moments in the concentration camps. It was still with her. If you take photographs like that, they remain imprinted on your brain.
A Nazi salute.
So Lee's only in Dachau for actually a few hours. What happens next is that she goes to Hitler's apartment.
This is an example of the working partnership of Lee and David, the really efficient news-gathering partnership, which means that you find a goal and you head for it. And if you're lucky, you scoop the opposition.
I've been carrying Hitler's Munich address around in my pocket for years, and finally I had a chance to use it, but mine host wasn't home.
We wound up in Hitler's home on 27 Regent Street, which the bunch of GIs had simply taken over as a place to crash. And that was the spot that we got some GIs to read a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf with their feet up on Hitler's bed, lying on Hitler's pillow.
I took some pictures of the place, and I also got a good night's sleep in Hitler's bed. I even washed the dirt of Dachau off in his own tub.
We hadn't seen a bathtub for weeks. So Lee immediately jumped into the bathtub, and I photographed her, and I locked the door so we wouldn't be disturbed. And suddenly there was this tremendous banging on the door. The lieutenant was dying to get in and shave. And he said, you know, get out of there. You know, whoever you are, you've been in there too long. It was sort of the last of the Hitler myth right there in that spot that night.
The story of Lee Miller in Hitler's bathtub has spread around the world, and it's the one with which she's most identified. It's got all the elements, a beautiful woman sitting in a bath with no clothes on. There is an equivalent photograph by Lee of David Sherman in the bath, and nobody is very interested in looking at that one.
David pulls a face as he scrubs his hair in the bathtub. The photo of Lee is published in a magazine with other photos in Hitler's house.
That photograph, for many years after the war, was actually completely forgotten. And it was really only after her death that it became as well known as it currently is today. So initially, the idea was just to have a bath. And then they realized what the circumstances were, and between them, they made an enduring story out of it.
They placed the photograph of Hitler by Heinrich Hoffmann, Hitler's pet photographer, and it was actually a kind of vanity shot. But the key to the shot is the boots, because those boots carried Lee around Dachau that morning, and now she's grinding the filth of that place into Hitler's nice, clean bath mat.
In the tub, Lee glances away over her shoulder as she washes her back with a cloth.
And of course, what neither of them knew in that moment was way across Germany in Berlin at 4:45 that afternoon, Hitler and Eva Braun had killed themselves. And so there's this kind of incredible closing of a circle in that image, as well as that defiance of stamping the filth into Hitler's bath mat.
London, 1946. An open-mouthed sculpture in a front garden.
A strange-looking carving by the modern sculptor Henry Moore watches the arrival of a young lady whose comings and goings make news. The name is Lee Miller, press photographer, just back from gathering scoops on the continent. Roland Penrose, surrealist artist, welcomes her back and helps her to get rid of the baggage she's had to hump round on her news-getting jobs.
The end of the war was, I think, the most difficult thing that Lee faced. And she really got lost. I think, in a way, she recognized that she was beaten.
Lee admires a kitten.
Sure, she was a peacetime casualty in many ways.
David.
Her objectives had been taken away from her. Her raison d'etre was taken away from her. Roland, by this time, had sort of given up on her. She was not answering his letters.
He'd taken up with someone else in London. And I saw Lee's position as being badly threatened.
Anthony.
Eventually, it was Sherman who said, go home.
Playing with the kitten.
And it was, I guess, with a big sigh that she did decide finally to knock it off and go back home.
It is as if she opens the door, walks back into her life with Roland, and nothing has changed. It couldn't be further from the truth. He had to learn afresh how it was to have this deeply damaged and disturbed person who he loved. He had to cope with all of that.
Lee inspecting a photograph in front of a typewriter.
She tried to go back into fashion, taking pictures of hats and handbags, and tried to kind of go back to how things were before the war. But when you've watched such life-changing things, then it's very hard to adjust.
She's told by, you know, a doctor she goes to see to pull herself together. She is also a raging alcoholic by this point. She then has lost her looks. So the biggest power that she has always played on has gone. Then we add that she gets pregnant. Then she may well have had postnatal depression. I mean, she didn't find it very easy to be a mother. And then, Roland Penrose, who sees the woman of his life just being absolutely destroyed, comes up with a bright idea, because he's very tin-eared, Roland, to move this woman, who is completely urban, who loves connecting with people, to a lonely farm in the country where she knows nobody, with a newborn baby. It's astonishing to me that she actually survived.
A black and white photograph of Lee sitting cross-legged on a bench and gazing into the distance. Georgina Erskine, family friend.
I think lost is a good way to describe her at Farley Farm. I think Lee was such a complicated person. All we could see, as you know, Tony and I, growing up, was somebody who was just difficult.
I get a sense that she was dissociated. It's something that she used effectively, and as a model, she could just disconnect from her surroundings, disconnect from everything, and just be this beautiful object. And later, when she became the combat photographer and was in this terrible danger, witnessing awful things, I think she used that sense of dissociation to detach from the horror that surrounded her. And I think that sense of dissociation, that sense of disconnect between her emotional side and her physical side, inevitably came from her childhood trauma.
Carolyn.
The story of what happened to Lee when she was 7 years old is hard to clarify. She was staying with friends of the family, very good friends, in, I believe, Brooklyn, for a sort of holiday. These friends left the little girl in the care of a young man who was either a boarder or a relative. And what we know is that he took advantage of this time, and he did indeed rape the little girl.
a family photo with a young Lee.
After the rape, she was rushed home. She was subjected to the most painful, humiliating treatment available at the time because she developed a sexually transmitted disease. Her mother, who was a nurse, had to administer this extraordinarily painful treatment every day. Her brother heard his sister screaming in the bathroom, and the whole thing was, of course, hush-hush, because this was a huge scandal, and no one wanted it to be known that this had happened to little Elizabeth Miller.
The shadowy figure presses its fingers gently against the foggy glass. A middle-aged Lee gazing into a mirror.
It was the final piece in the puzzle. I could never really understand why she was so secretive. But as a child, she had learned to keep secrets. And that was important for her survival. And she was good at it.
Later in life, Lee is covered with a blanket while sleeping on a sofa.
Why she buried the past and all of those photographs in boxes in the attic? Perhaps she wanted to put it behind her, not dwell on these most painful times and images and moments, rather than address them head on.
Grass with white feathery plumes shivers in the wind. Lee eventually conquered her demons. Cooking became her next great passion. Her dinner parties were legendary. Anthony.
When she died, emotionally it affected me personally very little. And I didn't really shed tears for her until I began writing her biography. And that's when I began to really understand her, and that's when I practically drowned my word processor. Because I realized how much I'd missed. There was so much I wish I'd known about her and understood. Yes, it's been an extraordinary voyage of understanding.
Lee Miller, 1907 to 1977. The interview with David.
When Lee died, I wanted to write an obit for American Vogue because she died totally unrecognized. I wanted to write an obit, and I got to thinking about what the form the obit would take. Because she led 6, 8, 10 discrete, totally different lives.
Photos of Lee throughout the years.
She was an amazing, unusual person. Exasperating person, lovable person, beautiful person, ugly person. She was all of these different things. Those were her different lives.
The temptation is to seek women that aren't quite so challenging. But what we need are examples like Lee Miller. We need women that are complicated and fully three-dimensional.
When I think about Lee Miller, it wasn't that she was leaning in to be taken seriously by the men. She didn't even care. She's just a woman who did not apologize for who she was.
The portrait of Lee staring ahead with heavy makeup and her short hair slicked back.